He kept chasing this idea of freedom and impunity. He wanted to become a completely sovereign individual. Because this offshore universe that Landy had sought shelter in is not so exceptional after all. It's all around us, and it's hiding in plain sight. Hopping from jurisdiction to jurisdiction with two goals: to make money and shield it as best they can, and themselves from responsibility.
In dieser Folge geht's nicht einfach um Steueroasen, Briefkastenfirmen und dubiose Konten. Atusa Araxi Abrahamian erzählt die Geschichte eines Mannes, der Offshore radikal wörtlich genommen hat. Samuele Landy, italienischer Unternehmer, verurteilter Betrüger, Krypto-Fan und Freiheitsfanatiker. Er entzog sich jahrzehntelang Staaten, Gesetzen und Behörden. Erst mit Schweizer Konten und Firmenkonstrukten, später dann mit einem Diplomatenpass und am Ende sogar auf einer rostigen Plattform mitten im Meer. Außerdem spricht Abrahamian darüber, warum Dubai heute das neue Offshore-Paradies ist und warum auch reiche Menschen oft gar nicht ohne Gesetze leben wollen, sondern einfach dorthin gehen, wo die Gesetze für sie günstiger sind. Und schließlich spricht sie auch darüber, warum diese ganze Offshore-Welt viel näher an unserem Alltag liegt, als man vielleicht denkt. Viel Spaß mit ihrer Lecture.
Hi everyone, I'm so glad to be here today. Thank you for having me. So as Anna said, I'm Atusa Araxi Abrahamian and I live in New York, so I've come a long way, but I'm actually from Switzerland. It might surprise you with my funny name and my accent, but I lived 18 years in Geneva, which maybe you don't consider super Swiss, but you know, that's me. And as Anna said, I'm going to be talking about money and its borderlessness and where it goes to hide. But instead of lecturing you about trusts and shell companies and jurisdictions and all the stuff that tax lawyers like to go on and on about, no offense if there's tax lawyers in the room, I'm sure there's one, right? I'm gonna tell you about this topic through the story of a remarkable character named Samuele Landy. And in my head, he is the most offshore man in the world. I profiled Samuele Landy a year ago for the New York Times, so some of this talk is adapted from the article, which is online. And I think Mr. Landy is a perfect guide to this offshore world of hidden money and skirted rules. Because unlike tax lawyers and most of their clients, Samuele really inhabited this world. He lived in it. Not just on paper, not just on bank accounts or on identification documents, but in person, in the flesh. So, you know, some people think it's enough to move their assets to get away from the authorities. Well, Samuele did more. He moved his ass. Before I talk about Mr. Landy, though, and his slightly dodgy lifestyle, I wanted to take a minute to define what offshore even is, because it's a word you hear a lot, and it's a little, seems complicated, seems technical. So give me just a minute. This is a picture I found on the internet. It's a bit out of date, but it gives you an idea of the places that money goes. And it also illustrates a sort of a narrower definition of offshore. So in that definition, which you'd hear from the IMF or the World Bank or the tax attorney, it would be the global infrastructure that provides banking and financial services to non-residents. So I live here and I use that place to do my money stuff. Very rudimentary definition. And that's what you hear about. That's what the Panama Papers and the Paradise Papers and the LuxLeaks and the SwissLeaks and all of these scandals, that's what those are about. This is a huge problem in the world, right? Trillions of dollars are hidden offshore from the sight of the national tax authorities, what little we have of a global tax authority. And, you know, that wealth is taking away from national economies, from people. It's creating massive inequality. And, you know, we should also note, since we are in Switzerland, that it's probably not so, a lot of it is not so far from where we're sitting today. But a broader way of looking at the offshore world is to consider all of the places and spaces above, beneath, within, and in between nation states that let governments and people get away with something that they wouldn't be allowed to do at home. So that can include avoiding tax. It can mean staying out of jail. It can mean polluting the environment, committing human rights abuses, and all matter of defiance of international law. And the space itself can vary wildly. It can be a bank vault. Offshore can be a boat. Offshore can be an entire island nation. Recently, you've probably read that the United States has started sending migrants and asylum seekers to El Salvador. That's a kind of offshore, I would argue. You might have heard about the Geneva Freeport, which is a warehouse in Geneva where wealthy people will store art and wine and other very expensive objects. That's also offshore, even though it's in Geneva proper. You can go up to it and look at it, and maybe you can even touch it. And that's because the rules of that warehouse are different from the rules onshore. The warehouse is outside of Swiss customs regime, so it's gated. It has fences around it. And has anybody seen the movie Tenet, the Christopher Nolan movie? So that movie is entirely offshore, and that's a great example of what I'm talking about in this broader conception. Offshore is a financial playbook, but as we'll see, it's also a state of mind and a lifestyle, a series of places that offer sovereignty and impunity where no one can tell you what to do. And that is what made it so very appealing to our main man of the hour, Samuele Landi. This is Samuele. I'll start with a spoiler. Samuele is not among us anymore. He died 2 years ago doing what he loved. He died the way he lived, offshore. He was in a boat. You know, once a pirate, always a pirate. Oh, this is Shatzi, a notorious money launderer. This is one of Samuele's cats. I hope you'll enjoy his story. So Samuele Landi was born and raised in Arezzo, Italy. That's a Tuscan town a couple of hours drive from Rome. And as far as anybody can tell, he lived as a law-abiding private citizen until his 30s, when he started working in the telecommunications industry. Now, I've written about these types of people for a long time, and it's interesting because lots of these hacker cryptocurrency entrepreneurs got their start in telecoms. I think it's because you know, they were tinkering with computers and going in forums and stuff. They actually knew how to use the computer in the 1990s, unlike most of us, and they discovered this whole connected world where the rules didn't really apply and it wasn't entirely clear who was in charge. So Landi was one of these guys. And he told friends that he thought of himself as a kind of an Italian Steve Jobs, very modest man. In retrospect, John McAfee, the annoying virus antivirus guy, is a better comparison because he too died on the run from the law somewhere in South America. So Landi's first company was called Plugit International, and it was involved in some really clever arbitrage schemes. Italy was deregulating its telecoms industry and ceding control of telecommunications to private companies. And just as that was happening, Plugit intervened and bought lots of really easy-to-remember phone numbers, you know, 999-444-333-6969, to weather forecasts, movie schedules, fortune tellers, and, you know, some phone sex operators also. That was what it was best known for. And the way it worked is that Plugit bought these numbers, it sold them to these entrepreneurs, and then people would phone them to get the weather or the movie forecast or the, you know, the sexy stuff, and they would get billed through their phone bill. They would get billed a lot through their phone bill, so much that the Italian financial regulator started to investigate Plugit for the fees because they were very, very high. In his free time, Landi was a bit of an adrenaline junkie. He completed the Paris-Dakar motorcycle race several times. He was quite well known in Arezzo, along with his teammates. And he and his teammates turned motorcycling into sort of a local hobby, a very popular local hobby. These are actual photos of Landy. He's in the water, in the sand, and skydiving. That's actually one of those people is Landy. I don't know which one. And that is actually Arezzo. He got really into skydiving and ended up supporting and funding a local skydiving club. So he also put this on the map for Arezzo. He called the skydiving club Tortuga, which some of you might know is the legendary island of the pirates. And on the business side, he was a bit of a pirate too. A small aside, you might notice that this portrait that he took of himself in a photo mat looks a lot like the symbol of the Arditi, the Italian shock units in World War I, that then Mussolini really loved this iconography and used it a lot. So, side note, may or may not be relevant later. As Landy was doing his extracurriculars and pretending to be a pirate, he was also kind of a pirate in real life. In 2003, Plugit, the phone number company, merged with another company to become a legit, full-blown phone and internet provider called Utelia. I say legit, but Utelia was very much a family affair. There were Landys serving as managers, and Landys serving as executives, and Landys controlling shares, and uncles and brothers and cousins expanding the business abroad. So much that a prosecutor I interviewed made it sound rather like The Sopranos. So Utelia did quite well. At one point, it was like the fourth or fifth biggest telecoms company in Italy. And it listed on the Milan Stock Exchange in 2004. Some of these Landys made lots of money very quickly. And Landy's wife, who'd bought some shares, with the proceeds of the stock increase, bought this castle not far from Arezzo. I may or may not have given myself a tour. It's very nice. And we know this because, A, there are property records, and B, the police actually investigated Mrs. Landy to make sure there was no fraud involved, and actually this is totally legit castle that she bought with very clean money. Meanwhile, other trouble was brewing for Utelia. In 2006, the Italian financial police began to audit Utelia's books for potential fraud. And they looked and they looked and they found a whole lot of nothing, which is bad when you're doing a fraud investigation because it means that maybe there is actually lots of fraud. The authorities discovered plenty of irregularities. Tens of millions of euros were improperly accounted for. And in the process of this investigation, these cops found themselves in a total rabbit hole of offshore finance. They found that as early as 2002, this is quite a while ago, Samuele Landy and five of his relatives had used falsified invoices to siphon money from the business in Italy and into tax shelters all around the world. These tax shelters included a Romanian LLC in Bucharest, fully owned by a Swiss firm, a UBS account in Monaco, because there's always a UBS account, and a shell company on the Polynesian island of Niue. I called up some tax haven historians when I was trying to wrap my head around this. And I called up a historian at Yale called Vanessa Ogle. And I said, Vanessa, have you ever heard of this place? And she said, in my time writing histories of tax havens, I have never heard of Niue. So that gives you a sense of how advanced and creative these guys were. And I just want to emphasize that these were a bunch of relatives in Arezzo. This was not like PwC or a big accounting firm or even a bank. These were a bunch of guys with an internet connection who figured out just how far their money could go and just how much they could get away with until they didn't. So these corporate vehicles that they set up in all of these places, they had. When I say that the prosecutors found nothing, these companies had no or few employees, produced no tangible work, and existed, according to the prosecutors, entirely for the purpose of just draining Utelia's coffers. which created problems for Utelli as workers, because when there's no money, you can't get paid. And when you don't get paid, you go on strike. And that's exactly what Utelli as workers did. They staged an occupation of their offices in Rome, and they occupied their offices for a good 2 weeks, and at some point, Samuele Landi got kind of pissed off, and he hit back. And he did so in a way that, again, is also a little more reminiscent of The Sopranos than a telecom CEO. So with 15 of his tough guys by his side, Landi marched into the office at 5 in the morning one November morning, and he wanted to disrupt the sit-in. They came with crowbars. His guys dragged the workers out of their office and took them into the lobby. But unfortunately for them, a television reporter was covering the occupation, and the TV reporter called the police, and the police took Landi and his men away. This was the beginning of the end for Utelli and for Landi. Many of the company's executives had to face the law in Italy. His brother, uncle, cousins, they all had to defend themselves against charges. Some eventually ended up being sentenced to prison. None of them served because they were first-time offenders. But by the time their court dates came around, somebody, Mr. Landi, had escaped. Does anyone know where this is? Yeah. But first, does anyone know where this is? He ended up in Dubai, but not before making a stop in Ghentan, which prosecutors say was Landi's last stop in Europe. This is now apparently a wellness hotel. Because it's not an offshore story if there isn't a Swiss link. The Italian prosecutors also noted that Landi had accounts at the Banca della Svizzera Italiana in Lugano, and also, of course, at Julius Baer. Classic move. Of course, we all know that Switzerland pioneered this offshore business, right? And this was back, he started this in 2002. It was much easier to get away with things then. The banks are now subject to more stringent reporting requirements that make it harder. But in Landi's time, it was a free-for-all, and, you know, it was right next door, so why wouldn't he use it? Anyway, back to Dubai. Why would Mr. Landi go to Dubai? Many reasons. The city-state levied no taxes on foreign citizens. It had, very importantly, no extradition agreement with Italy. And it was developing a reputation as a place where criminals and their money could find safe haven and sort of launder the whole thing. There's a reason that people started calling Dubai the new Switzerland. All of these accommodations and this little financial crisis that made things very, very, you know, complicated allowed Landi to establish himself very quietly in the United Arab Emirates and eventually to move his wife and children there as well. He was even able to start a new business. So, you know, life went on. His family faced the law. Landi was in Dubai. And in 2010, he registered a company called CryptoTel, an encrypted mobile phone company, in Dubai. He hired his old skydiving friends to be his staff. I know this because they posted on LinkedIn. people love to post things on LinkedIn. Why? he registered CryptoTel. I said in Dubai, but actually he did something very interesting. So CryptoTel, a little bit about it. This was in 2010. You might remember the Edward Snowden leaks were big news then. We all suddenly realized that everyone was spying on us all the time. And Landi was a libertarian, so he already knew this and felt this deeply. And now this was confirmation that, yes, everyone is always spying on us. So CryptoTel was supposed to prevent that from happening. He sold these devices to individuals. He sold them to governments, apparently. And he said that he sought clients who could pay him in cryptocurrency. And then he would take the cryptocurrency, when he needed cash, he would convert it to dollars or dirhams or, you know, whatever he wanted in order to spend it. And again, Dubai was a good place for this because they were quite permissive. And back then it was difficult to go between crypto and dollars or crypto and dirhams or crypto and francs. Now there's ways to make it easier. But so he found the place where it was easy. But back to CryptoTel's registration. He found, so Dubai has lots of special economic zones. Special economic zones are places in a country that have a different set of rules. The nerds among us might call them onshore, offshore. That makes perfect sense if you think about their logic, because say I'm standing here and I'm onshore, but here there's a different set of rules where I can punch you in the face and it's totally fine. That, think of that as a special punching zone. Same thing happens for economics, where in the zone, lower taxes, easier to incorporate, you can hire your friends in Italy without a, you know, visa paperwork. It's much more permissive. And Landy made use of this onshore, offshore to open his company in Dubai. I want to take a minute to talk about these special economic zones because there's way more of them than countries, and we think of them as special and countries as ordinary. But I would argue that maybe they are not so special and that countries are quite extraordinary on the grand scheme of things in terms of law and land and who they help. In Dubai, the special economic zone business started off in ports. So there are in the Persian Gulf, there's lots of shipping that goes on. And in the early 2000s, Dubai decided, we're going to make this port a free zone to make it easier to have imports and exports. That's fairly simple. That's a fairly like analog concept of the special economic zone. You have lower tariffs. You can, you know, have import-export business more easily. The next permutation of the zones was catering to more knowledge economy businesses, finance, banking, internet, even medical tech. And these zones started to accumulate kinds of laws that you wouldn't see in the old industrial or port zones. One of them in Dubai, and I thought this was so interesting, has even its own court system. This place is called the Dubai International Financial Center, and it has an entire court system that is both within the UAE system and in parallel to it. And it exists entirely to serve basically wealthy foreigners. So this is a picture from the, not from where CryptoTel was registered, but from the DIFC. So Landy lived in one of these. I don't know which one. This is a place called Palm Jumeirah. It is an archipelago of man-made islands. And Landy had a really nice life. He had a villa. He had a driver. He probably had house cleaners and chefs and all of the rest. And he followed the news as one after another, his brothers and uncles and cousins and whatnot, we're getting into trouble and, you know, facing the law. Samueli Landy was actually sentenced to a total of 14 years in prison in absentia for his role in the Utelia fraud. But in Dubai, he was untouchable because there was no extradition treaty. At the same time, Landy was super online. He bought a local news magazine in Arezzo. Unclear why he bought it, but he was posting on it a lot, and he seemed very preoccupied with what was going on back home. So I called up a friend of his in Arezzo, who was the editor of that newspaper at the time, and I asked him, you know, what was Landy saying to you? And he said, oh, Landy was untouchable. He thought he was totally untouchable. Whenever there was a rumor, and there are a lot of rumors in Arezzo, whenever there was a rumor that he was in trouble, he would send a selfie of himself on the beach with a newspaper. And then I asked this friend, seriously, like, didn't he even miss Arezzo a tiny bit? And his friend said, he would say no. He would say, I would only come back for my mother. So, nice Italian boy. So until now, we've watched our friend Samuele game the system, right? He has gotten out of Italy, he's moved his money, he's incorporated in this funny zone. But what's really interesting is how he's doing illegal stuff, especially back home. He did lots of things that were found to be illegal by courts. But he's using the laws of other nations to protect himself. Bank secrecy in Switzerland, crypto stuff in Dubai, extradition treaties. He made himself untouchable by going to the right places. And I think this speaks to another misconception that there's a sense that rich people want to live a lawless existence, especially the slightly shady ones. But that's not right. I think that all of us, but especially rich people, want places with laws that work for them. And if you have enough money, these places are numerous. We are told over and over that borders protect nations, but the other side of that is that borders also protect money and people with money, thanks to their rule of law. That's actually the operating principle of the offshore world. You don't have to break the law or face the law if you find the laws that support what you want to do. So the big question is, what happens when you run out of those places? Landy had a few more tricks. What is going on here? This is part of a video. I'm not going to show it because it's not very interesting. This was taken on March 22nd, 2022. And the man at the front is Liberia's former president, Liberia, the country, George Weah, former footballer. And he was in Dubai for a diplomatic visit. At the terminal, a delegation of Liberian officials were there to greet him. And standing a little bit taller than his peers was a man with a white, shiny, bald head. This is our friend, Samuel Elandi. What the heck is Samuel Elandi doing at the Dubai airport with a bunch of Liberian guys and a woman? Also a great question. Samuel Elandi was at the airport with the president of Liberia in his capacity as Liberia's honorary consul general to Dubai. He found yet another loophole. This appointment by Liberia, a country he had never been a resident of, he had no connection to through family or even marriage, this country had granted him immunity from prosecution in Dubai by making him a diplomat. So to be fair to Samuel Elandi, he did some business in Liberia. He bought, through Utelia, a $21 million stake in a company called Netcom Liberia, one of the many companies that prosecutors investigated and found nothing. And I guess since then, he had made some friends there, including the wife of the convicted war criminal, Charles Taylor, as well as some other Liberian officials and statesmen and entrepreneurs. And over time, Samuele had parlayed those relationships into a very special, even honorable posting. For an offshore man of mystery and ill repute, a diplomatic passport is kind of like an invisibility cloak in Harry Potter, you know, that brings with it varying degrees of immunity, and not to mention an alternative passport to travel and transact with. It's like having a new face, untethered from the past. Honorary consuls can do lots of things that you and I can't do. They can move assets across borders in a special inviolable bag called a diplomatic pouch. They can have cars with diplomatic plates that avoid parking tickets and speeding fines. They enjoy the immunity and privilege of not being searched by the police pretty much ever. And even their homes, like Landy's, are considered off limits because they are state offices, not villas. So we don't really think about passports as part of the broader offshore world, but diplomatic papers have been helping criminals and crooks get around the law for at least a century. The historian I spoke to about Niue said that it's a time-honored strategy going back to the 1920s. And indeed, in 2022, the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists found 500 current and former honorary consuls had been accused of crimes or embroiled in controversy. Samuel Elandi is not on the list, so I'm going to call it 501. But here's a twist. Most of these honorary consul gigs are just for show. I've met a few of these characters, and they, you know, they don't really do a whole lot for their nation. But Landy took his job really, really seriously. According to at least three people who spent time with Landy in Dubai, he threw himself into the job. He did fundraising from wealthy Arab donors to build a hospital near Monrovia in Liberia. And he even hosted and funded and catered a Liberian Independence Day party at his home. That's not all. Samuele Landy used his consular powers to help repatriate dozens of Liberian domestic workers who'd been trafficked into Oman. That's Oman. It's a long story, but his phone, his WhatsApp was listed on the Liberian website, and some ladies who'd gotten into trouble in Oman contacted him. He got involved. It was all over WhatsApp. He never told anyone he was Italian. They all thought that he was a Liberian guy. I talked to a hostage negotiator that he was in touch with to try to get these women out. He had no idea that this was an Italian dude sitting in Dubai. He thought that he was a Liberian official. So he passed himself off as a proper diplomat. And he rented a safe house for these women, found drivers to take them away from their abusive employers, and he even paid for supplies and their repatriation flights himself. He also had some tactics that these human trafficking experts said that they would never advise that people do. He told some women to run away in an Uber. It was all a bit chaotic. But you know, you gotta give credit where it's due. Samuele Landy believed in freedom, both for himself and for these ladies, and he did everything he could to make sure that they had it. Landy also used his time in Dubai to consult for a startup run by an Emirati sheikh. The company was called Blue Carbon. It still exists. And it was using this logic of offshore, where you can't do something at home, so you're finding a way to do it abroad, and kind of twisting that logic to help polluting companies that pollute the planet buy their way out of it by buying large swaths of Liberian forest land and using that against their carbon responsibilities. It's a little convoluted, but I think that the logic of offshore also applies here. So it's interesting how this mentality can permeate all parts of life and work. So basically, life was pretty good for Samuele Landy in Dubai. He was there from at least 2008 till 2022 into COVID. Unfortunately, it couldn't stay that good. In May 2022, a Liberian businessman in the US was arrested with a fake diplomatic credential. This set off an investigation, and then Liberia declared that it would recall all of its diplomats all over the world. It turned out that there were dozens, if not hundreds of them floating around using Liberian diplomatic papers and not really having anything to do with anything. So Landy was real, but it didn't really help him. And that summer, there was an arguably even bigger blow to Samuele Landy in particular, because the UAE extradited an Italian drug trafficker and mobster who had been living in Dubai for years. So the writing's on the wall, right? They're extraditing Italians. They're taking away Liberian passports. Not good. So Landy's many layers of protection, the villa, the passport, the diplomatic post, were getting shakier and shakier. So what's an offshore man to do next? Landy had another idea. He mapped out his next move that took him offshore, not just in a metaphorical sense, but in a physical one too. You see, on land, in the world of nation states, Landy had really reached the end of the line. And this little voice in his head that had led him far from home, under fictitious flags, to inhabit man-made villas and on man-made islands and extraterritorial havens, was now telling him to leave land entirely. So everyone was quite surprised when Landy moved onto this thing, the A Island, on December 22nd, 2022. He moved there with the cat that I showed you and four kittens that he found in a box under his car. No one knew anything about his plans, but he really believed that he had a future at sea. He thought he could actually live out the rest of his days on the ocean. This might sound original or weird, but there's a whole movement before Landy that was premised about life on the ocean. And it also happens to share Landy's libertarian philosophy of exiting and evading and avoiding. This movement is called seasteading. I like to say that it's like homesteading, but wetter. But the short version of seasteading, which has a pretty interesting history of its own, is that in 2008, Peter Thiel, who everyone's heard of, and Milton Friedman's grandson, Patry Friedman, started a foundation called the Seasteading Institute. And the Seasteading Institute was intended to promote the creation of new nations at sea. Again, this was a libertarian enterprise. So there was an element of like regulatory avoidance and tax avoidance and wanting to go somewhere where there was no rules, basically, no boss and no rules. But it was weird enough that it got a lot of mainstream attention. And I think for good reason. It's a really wonderful thought experiment. Why can't we have hundreds of new nations? Why is the ocean the only place where there aren't national rules? Like, all of these questions are very, very good ones. That said, seasteading comes from a motivation for excluding people, for evading laws, and for wanting a place of your own to basically avoid other people, rather than to be inclusive and to create something, you know, progressive and interesting and forward-thinking. So I can't endorse seasteading, but I think I love talking about it. And a lot of the seasteaders also like talking about it, but very few of them would inconvenience themselves to the point that they're moving on to this thing, right? Who wants that? So they're not up for it, but Samuele Landi, adventurer and thrill seeker that he was totally up for it. On the one hand, it was his only choice. On the other hand, he liked adventure. He told one podcaster, he took a couple of interviews from the barge, he said, if you are libertarian like we are, the other guy was also a libertarian, if you are libertarian like we are, you want your freedom. And your freedom is finished when the freedom of others begins. That is the key point. Yeah, this is... So... The ship itself was a barge. It was rusting. It was rectangular. It had the footprint of a large plane. And on the deck, Landy fitted out 6 blue shipping containers bolted in place. This is where the men lived. He hired some sailors and a cook, and he had the cats. And the shipping containers had air conditioning, desalination, and Starlink Wi-Fi. Thanks to Elon Musk's, of course, there's always Elon Musk, right? Otherwise, what was there? There wasn't much to do. The barge was littered with ropes and crates and fans and tanks, oil, water. He had a big freezer with pounds and pounds of red meat. He had a sack of reinforced concrete for repairs. And he hadn't given up his allegiance to good old Liberia. There's a Liberian flag. He never registered it with the Liberian shipping authorities. He just like the flag, I guess. And Landy was really good at living at sea. He grew vegetables. He made plans to bring chickens. He had a blog where he was really happy about how few mosquitoes there were on the barge. He wrote very poetic posts about the sunsets, and he posted about his cats and his adventures. And, you know, I think he was really bored. He relied on his crew and semi-regular deliveries of food and supplies from Dubai. And he was able to, thanks to the internet, he was able to keep CryptoTel in business as well. While on the ocean, Landy also fell in with a group of fringe people called the Citizens of Liberland. The Free Republic of Liberland is a self-professed sovereign state on the Danube River between Serbia and Croatia. It claims it's the freest country in the world. They say that with sovereign land, no bureaucracy, and voluntary taxes, Liberland uses Bitcoin alongside the Liberland dollar, LLD, as currencies of choice. Liberland's motto, to live and let live, gives you the idea of the company he was keeping. And the guy in the suit, in the middle, Viet is the president of Liberland, went to visit Samuel Leilandi on his boat and made him an ambassador for Liberland. I called up Viet Jedlicka to ask him about Landy, and he was sort of evasive, and yeah, it was bumpy, it was kind of hard to get to this barge, and he said, oh, but Landy was a citizen, he was one of us, he was one of us. 20 minutes later, he calls me back, and he says, Atusa, actually, he wasn't a citizen. Samuel Leilandi would never pass our stringent due diligence process to become a citizen of Liberland. So, I don't know. So he's keeping some pretty wacky company, and it gets wackier. People who were talking to Leilandi at this time said he sounded quite paranoid. He'd been cryptically speaking about wanting to escape the Matrix. This is a meme online, but it's a metaphor for the movie, and it means letting go of constructed social norms and false beliefs. And he was also obsessed with 5G and the COVID vaccine and all of this kinds of stuff that was happening in 2022. Still, he did not completely lose touch with reality, because Leilandi knew that he couldn't stay on this barge in this place for very much longer. He told the podcast that he was interviewed for, he said, for the moment, Dubai is tolerating us, but we cannot stay. It also didn't help that this used barge that he'd bought for $200,000 from a junkyard, an actual junkyard, this thing was supposed to be scrapped, had all these leaks, was getting damaged in the water, and Leilandi and his men had to teach themselves aquatic welding. And I quote again from an interview. He said, from welding from the inside, there are certain dangers because you are exposed to gas. But if you weld from outside, it's more difficult because you're in a scuba diving suit fighting the current and the waves. I don't understand how underwater welding works, but he did it. So he knew he had to move, and this boat was not going anywhere fast. And Leilandi hatched his final plan while he was living on the A Island. He would not settle for a barge. He would settle only for a new country, still on the ocean, but much further away. He had plans to buy a new boat, twice as large. He would anchor it in the Saya de Mala Bank, midway between Seychelles and Mauritius. And once he was there, he would invite friends and family and other libertarians to join him. He had plans, very detailed plans, even hired an architect to deck it out with guns and cannons, as well as chickens and internet. He had solar panels planned out. He had desalination systems, a gym, friends. Basically, this was Samuel Leilandi's idea of heaven. About a month before Samuele died, a documentary filmmaker went to visit him. His name is Ozzy Horowitz. And Ozzy showed me some of the footage, and I was really struck by Landy's whole vibe. He seemed so self-actualized. In France, there's a word, épanoui. He just seems like he's living his best life. His skin is glowing, he's laughing, he seems happy, he seems really at peace with the universe. And this struck me, because when I talked to people, I thought he was losing his mind on this boat. Apparently not so. He even seemed to see the humor in his predicament. He also seemed to realize quite clearly the danger that he was putting himself in. He told the documentary filmmaker that he was sure that he would die at sea. He didn't really have any other options, and it was better than being locked up. Leilandi always liked to live on the edge of the world, the edge of the law, and the edge of life himself. And he sent his last message to this filmmaker on New Year's Eve 2023. The message read, "Move or die." A month later, Landy's barge was about 30 miles from the Dubai coast when a rogue wave hit him, breaching the hull and apparently breaking the barge cleanly in two. Two members of the crew survived by clinging onto pieces of wood until a passing vessel rescued them the next day. So they were in the water for like almost 24 hours. Leilandi and two other of the seafarers were not so lucky, and nor were the cats. According to Italian news, they put out a call for help, but they didn't come in time to help. And his body was found a few days later when it washed up on a beach about 40 miles up the coastline from Dubai. A relative identified the body. In the seasteading community, Landy's remembered as a heroic figure. The head of the Seasteading Institute told me Samuele was the first seasteader to live in international waters for more than a year, but they note that barges are not safe. So if anyone's thinking about doing this, don't do it. It's a bad idea. Back in Arezzo, where I went to talk to people, not everyone was buying it. Even the city's mayor couldn't believe that Arezzo's most notorious exile was gone. Because think about it, this is a man who found his way around everything. Rules, taxes, borders, laws. Surely, Samuele Landi would resurface. I want to end on a more philosophical note. So Landi's life was crazy, and his whole worldview might sound like lunacy to most people. Who wants to make a country on a barge in international water with guns? And it's nuts. But for a veteran of offshore affairs like Samuele Landi, it's all part of the same logic. He kept chasing this idea of freedom and impunity. He wanted to become a completely sovereign individual. Landi was right about a lot of things. He saw the world as it was, and he made it work for him. But he was wrong about one thing. Landi was not escaping the Matrix. He was part of the Matrix. Because this offshore universe that Landi had sought shelter in is not so exceptional after all. It's all around us, and it's hiding in plain sight. We might buy a bottle of scotch at a duty-free shop, or vacation on a cruise ship with a Liberian flag. We might gamble in a casino or admire a Da Vinci that spent decades in a Freeport in Geneva. Our clothes, our electronics, this computer, maybe the screen, all of these objects that we spend hours with every day have probably been manufactured in special economic zones by global companies that all behave more or less like Samuele Landi, hopping from jurisdiction to jurisdiction with two goals: to make money and shield it as best they can and themselves from responsibility. Thank you.
Danke, dass du diese Podcast-Episode gehört hast. Ich hoffe, sie hat dir gefallen und du konntest etwas Neues erfahren und lernen. Und wenn du schon mal da bist, lass uns doch eine Bewertung oder ein paar Sternchen da. Das würde uns sehr helfen. Und wenn du mehr Vorträge vom AHA-Festival hören willst, abonniere diesen Podcast und folge uns auf Instagram. Auch über Feedback freuen wir uns sehr. Schreib uns eine Mail an am@aha-festival.ch. AHA, ein Podcast für Wissen, ist eine Zusammenarbeit von Christoph Fellmann und mir, Anna Matijašević. Mitproduziert und komponiert hat Nikola Miloš Mišić.